From NPR News, this is special coverage, the end of the 2000 presidential election. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. In just a few moments, Vice President Gore will address the nation 5 weeks after Americans went to the polls to cast ballots for president. Late last night, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to reverse a Florida Supreme Court ruling that had called for a hand count of thousands of disputed ballots. That was Gore's last opportunity to improve his vote total in the state. The certified totals in Florida give Texas Governor George W. Bush just a few hundred votes more than Gore, but it is enough for him to win Florida's 25 electoral votes and the presidency.
Mr. Bush is scheduled to address the nation coming up, and that's in 1 hour. He will speak from the Texas House of Representatives in Austin, Texas. The vice president will deliver his speech from his office at the old executive office building that's next to the White House. We should mention we've just learned that Mr. Gore has called Mr. Bush to congratulate him on the victory, and the words of the Associated Press conceding the presidential race. We'll have to wait and see if Mr. Gore actually uses those words in his talk tonight. Linda, anything symbolic here about the locations of these two speeches?
I think because it is an official office. It's his office in the building, which is next door to the White House. And it looks as though this may be the closest that the vice president is going to get to the White House, at least for a number of years. The vice president is coming into the room. His children and the Liebermans are there. Here is the vice president.
Good evening. Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. And I promised him that I wouldn't call him back this time. I offered to meet with him as soon as possible so that we can start to heal the divisions of the campaign and the contest through which we've just passed. Almost a century and a half ago, Senator Stephen Douglas told Abraham Lincoln, who had just defeated him for the presidency, "Partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you." Well, in that same spirit, I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country. Neither he nor I anticipated this long and difficult road. Certainly neither of us wanted it to happen. Yet it came, and now it has ended. Resolved as it must be resolved through the honored institutions of our democracy. Over the library of one of our great law schools is inscribed the motto, "Not under man, but under God and law." That's the ruling principle of American freedom, the source of our democratic liberties. I've tried to make it my guide throughout this contest, as it has guided America's deliberations of all the complex issues of the past 5 weeks. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken. Let there be no doubt. While I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession. I also accept my responsibility, which I will discharge unconditionally, to honor the new president-elect and do everything possible to help him bring Americans together in fulfillment of the great vision that our Declaration of Independence defines and that our Constitution affirms and defends. Let me say how grateful I am to all those who supported me and supported the cause for which we have fought. Tipper and I feel a deep gratitude to Joe and Hadassah Lieberman, who brought passion and high purpose to our partnership and opened new doors, not just for our campaign, but for our country. This has been an extraordinary election. But in one of God's unforeseen paths, this belatedly broken impasse can point us all to a new common ground, for its very closeness can serve to remind us that we are one people with a shared history and a shared destiny. Indeed, that history gives us many examples of contests as hotly debated, as fiercely fought, with their own challenges to the popular will. Other disputes have dragged on for weeks before reaching resolution. And each time, both the victor and the vanquished have accepted the result peacefully and in a spirit of reconciliation. so let it be with us. I know that many of my supporters are disappointed. I am too. But our disappointment must be overcome by our love of country. And I say to our fellow members of the world community, let no one see this contest as a sign of American weakness. The strength of American democracy is shown most clearly through the difficulties it can overcome. Some have expressed concern that the unusual nature of this election might hamper the next president in the conduct of his office. I do not believe it need be so. President-elect Bush inherits a nation whose citizens will be ready to assist him in the conduct of his large responsibilities. I personally will be at his disposal, and I call on all Americans. I particularly urge all who stood with us to unite behind our next president. This is America. Just as we fight hard when the stakes are high, we close ranks and come together when the contest is done. And while there will be time enough to debate our continuing differences, now is the time to recognize that that which unites us is greater than that which divides us. While we yet hold and do not yield our opposing beliefs, there is a higher duty than the one we owe to political party. This is America, and we put country before party. We will stand together behind our new president. As for what I'll do next, I don't know the answer to that one yet. Like many of you, I'm looking forward to spending the holidays with family and old friends. I know I'll spend time in Tennessee and mend some fences, literally and figuratively. Some have asked whether I have any regrets, and I do have one regret, that I didn't get the chance to stay and fight for the American people over the next 4 years, especially for those who need burdens lifted and barriers removed, especially for those who feel their voices have not been heard. I heard you, and I will not forget. I've seen America in this campaign, and I like what I see. It's worth fighting for, and that's a fight I'll never stop. As for the battle that ends tonight, I do believe, as my father once said, that no matter how hard the loss, defeat may serve as well as victory to shake the soul and let the glory out. So for me, this campaign ends as it began, with the love of Tipper and our family, with faith in God and in the country I have been so proud to serve, from Vietnam to the vice presidency, and with gratitude to our truly tireless campaign staff and volunteers, including all those who worked so hard in Florida for the last 36 days. Now the political struggle is over, and we turn again to the unending struggle for the common good of all Americans and for those multitudes around the world who look to us for leadership in the cause of freedom. In the words of our great hymn, America, America, let us crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. And now, my friends, in a phrase I once addressed to others, it's time for me to go. Thank you, and good night, and God bless America.
Vice President Al Gore speaking to the nation from the old Executive Office Building in Washington, D.C., next to the White House. Mr. Gore said about the Supreme Court decision, "I strongly disagree with it, but I accept it." And he went on to say, "I offer my concession." He said, "We will stand behind our new president." You're listening to special coverage of the end of the 2000 presidential election from NPR News.
We are gathered together here in the NPR studios with E.J. Dionne, who is a columnist for The Washington Post, and David Brooks, who is a senior editor at The Weekly Standard, who have been with us through other moments during this campaign to observe and interpret and talk about the things that have happened. E.J. and David, this was a speech which was, it was certainly an entirely gracious speech. There was no hint of anger in it. There was a great deal of talk about standing behind the president, coming together, closing ranks. But he didn't ever actually say, "He won and I lost." And E.J., you had said that you hoped he would not say that.
Right. I'm glad he didn't, because he doesn't believe it. I don't think he could have been more gracious than he was. I think he made clear that he disagreed with the court, but then he said he accepted the decision. And over again, he offered words of support to Governor Bush. He offered, he referred to him as president-elect. The other thing that struck me is this was not a last news conference speech. This was the first speech of the next campaign, is what it sounded like to me. When he said, "That's a fight I'll never stop," there were refrains in this speech which made it sound like we're going to have Al Gore to talk about for the next 4 years. At least he hopes so.
He did use some sort of phrases like the victor and the vanquished. He talked about, "I offer my concession." As Noah pointed out, he said that he disagreed very strongly with the decision that the U.S. Supreme Court made, but the court has spoken, and he said, "I accept the finality of this outcome." David, what's your impression?
I'm not sure I've ever seen Gore give such a good speech. It struck me that he hit exactly the right tones incredibly hard, and the two driving motivations for the speech were faith in God and patriotism. He hit the patriotic note again and again and again, to an extent that made Ronald Reagan blush when he started quoting America the Beautiful, or whatever, one of our national songs, and reverence to God. He talked about that again, that defeat can shake the soul and let the glory out. I think that in that way he rose above partisanship, rose above politics, as he was urging his supporters to do, and did it very eloquently, much more naturally than I'd seen him speak on the campaign trail. He did have that ripple in his voice when he said he strongly disagreed with the Supreme Court, but he also had a tone of modesty when he said he was going to Tennessee to mend fences, literally and metaphorically. So I think there was modesty and candor, which is not something I normally associate with him, but most of all, loftiness, which was the perfect tone. Well, excellent speech.
I think the only thing you could possibly interpret as a tiny little dig was that he was proud to have served his country from Vietnam to the vice presidency. And, of course, as we know, George Bush, who is approximately the same cohort, did not go to Vietnam.
Yeah, the only misstep I would say was the last line, "It's time for me to go." A little casual, a little too much of a little too cute, but because the rest of the tone was so stentorian.
Although it's funny, if you covered the 92 campaign and heard Al Gore say that over and over and over again about George W. Bush's father, I actually thought it was a nice touch and a funny touch, and that's how he intended it.
It was one of those call and response speeches. It's time for them to go, yeah. And then the audience would pick it up.
And then Cheney stole the line and used it in his speech at the convention, very consciously imitating Gore. I think that what's odd is that Al Gore has run a much better post-presidential campaign than he ran a presidential campaign. I think at a number of moments during this fight, he looked stronger and more in command than he did at many times during the campaign.
Let's thank you very much, EJ and David. Stay with us. We have, of course, Mr. Bush's speech to come, and more talk about Mr. Gore. So stick around.
Going to leave the studio now and find out what's happening at least on one street in the nation's capital, Massachusetts Avenue. NPR's Pam Fessler joins us. She's outside the vice president's residence in Northwest Washington. And Pam, describe this for people who haven't been to the Capitol lately. This is quite an elegant residence in the Naval Observatory grounds there. Tell us what it looks like.
Right. It's a big white Victorian house. It's actually quite beautiful. It's up on a slight hill and an incline. And right now it's just covered with Christmas decorations and lights. It's very bright. Outside we have several groups of protesters and supporters, but it's actually quite small compared to what it's been in recent weeks. I'd say there are about a dozen Bush supporters who are saying get out of Cheney's house, and then we have maybe about a half dozen Gore supporters who are saying that Bush is illegit.
This has been a place for protesters on either side to gather, one of the few places in Washington where they have come together, and you're saying the crowd is down a little bit this evening.
Right. Now, I should mention that it's also sleeting rain out here and very, very cold, so that might be one reason. Probably more interesting is what was going on inside the vice president's residence earlier this evening. One of the reasons that he did, in fact, speak at his office, at the old executive office building, was because there were previously scheduled Christmas parties here at the vice president's residence. And it just so turned out that the first party this evening was about for about 200 friends and supporters and people who had worked on the campaign all around the country. And I spoke with a few people as they left, and they said that it was actually very, very poignant inside, a very emotional time. There were a lot of tears among the from the supporters. The vice president and his wife, Tipper, went around and greeted every person individually and thanked them for all of their support. And they said that they had put up the good fight, but that it was time to concede at this point. At one point, I understand that Tipper Gore said, "I just want to introduce someone that I'm very, very proud of," and the whole crowd just cheered for the vice president.
Thank you, Pam. NPR's Pam Fester talking with us from outside the vice presidential residence in Northwest Washington on Massachusetts Avenue.
Bye.
Joining us now is the senator from Texas. Kay Bailey Hutchison is a Republican from Texas, but she's in Washington now. Ms. Hutchison, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
We wondered about your reaction to Mr. Gore's speech, if you think that he has set a scene here for your man, George Bush, who comes up next.
I do. I think the vice president was magnanimous. He had humor. He was truly, I thought it was a beautiful speech.
And it was not precise. I mean, he didn't precisely say that he had lost the election, but he did clearly concede. And do you think that was enough?
Oh, of course. I do. I don't think anyone is going to be nitpicking the vice president tonight. I think he did everything that he could do to begin the healing process. He said he called Governor Bush, and I thought it was cute when he said he promised not to call back this time. And then I think when he said he disagreed with the Supreme Court, of course, I think everyone understood that, but he also said he accepted their decision. And that is the essence of the American democracy. It's what keeps our democracy stable, and it is what keeps our Constitution working, that people can disagree, but when the Supreme Court rules, we accept their decision.
That there is no higher court and there is no other hand. The reference to not calling back was to election night when the vice president thought that he had lost Florida, called Governor Bush to concede. They had a conversation, and then as the Florida numbers began to change, he called back, and that's where the famous reference was to when Mr. Bush responded with some surprise. The vice president apparently said, "You don't have to get snippy about it."
Right. It was not probably a great conversation that night, but I thought he handled it very well tonight when he sort of made the joke. And I think that he really started something that's very important for Governor Bush and for the American people.
So,
by saying that he wanted to be there for Governor Bush for a smooth transition, and though he was disappointed, he was going to put America first.
What do you think, then, that we will hear from Governor Bush when he speaks to us, which will happen in about 40 minutes?
I think Governor Bush will show the same magnanimity. He will certainly, I think, refer to Vice President Gore's speech with a favorable comment. And I think he will then go forward to tell the American people that we must pull together, that too many people depend on us and too many lives depend on America being strong. And I think he will begin to set the course for what he wants to do in this administration.
He does face an unusual difficulty in that the Senate will be completely evenly divided, a tie. You, I assume, have been in touch with him about what is going to have to happen for the new president and the Senate to work together. What's been your advice?
Well, of course, I have talked to Governor Bush and visited with Dick Cheney today. Dick Cheney is going to be, I think, very hands-on with Congress because of the closeness of Congress and because, of course, he knows Congress so well, and I think he'll be a wonderful representative for President Bush. And I think they are going to be reaching out to all the people of Congress, the Democrats as well as the Republicans. They feel, of course, that they have made some promises to the American people that they would like to fulfill, but they also understand that they're going to have to work with the Democrats to try to make sure that they are part of the successes that we hope to gain.
Thanks very much, Senator Hutchison.
Thank you.
Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, she is a Republican from Texas, and she joined us from Washington.
And we will get a Democratic view now by talking to David Price, Democratic Congressman from North Carolina. Congressman Price, what were you listening for primarily? What did you really hope to hear in this speech tonight, and did you hear it?
I think it was a fine speech, I guess I was listening for a couple of things. First, some frank acknowledgement, which, of course, many people feel, of the hurt and the disappointment and kind of trauma that this has been over these last days, but also a concession and a pledge to work with the new president to make a smooth transition and to give him support as he takes office. There was also a very definite indication that the vice president disagreed with the Supreme Court's decision, as many of us do. I think the dissenting opinions are going to be treated much more kindly by history than the majority opinion. But we've got to move on, and we will have political battles. We will have differences, but we are one nation. Our country comes first. And I thought the vice president expressed that eloquently and persuasively. I'm sure it was difficult for him, but he it was a brave appearance, I think, and a courageous one, and a moving one. I think he was very, very effective.
I wonder, though, about that word concede, and I wonder if all Democrats would share your view of that. I looked it up in the dictionary. It says to concede is to acknowledge as true, just, or proper, often unwillingly. Are you sure that many Democrats were hoping he wouldn't use that word?
Well, I think the word has perhaps a different meaning to different people. I would think it would be inappropriate to make a statement of the factual situation with respect to the election outcome, and of course he didn't do that. But I think maybe people in the media had made a bit of a litmus test of whether he would use the C word, and I think he decided that he would just avoid that controversy and go ahead and say it, and I'm glad he did.
Looking ahead to Governor Bush's address coming up in about 37 minutes from Texas, you would be one of the Democrats that President Bush would reach out to. How do you feel that's going to go for you?
Well, I think Vice President Gore's speech was very, very important, and I think he stepped up to the plate magnificently. I think George W. Bush's speech is equally important. He, too, needs to acknowledge disappointment, pain, trauma, the things that people have been through in these last days, and needs to acknowledge that this election was basically a tie, and that he is he's called upon, I think, by this circumstance to make extraordinary efforts to reach out. He is entitled to the support of the American people, but we are entitled to see, I think, an unprecedented effort on his part to govern in a way that is inclusive and in terms of partisanship makes a genuine effort, not just to pick off a Democrat here and there for selected purposes, but genuinely to consult with the other side, Democrats across the spectrum. There's a whole agenda waiting, and I hope he will be very quick to pick a lot of these items, many of which have bipartisan support, which we could enact early on in the new Congress and give that show of unity and confidence. I hope you'll start us on that path tonight.
And finally, as a politician, did you hear anything that would leave the door open for 2004 that Al Gore may be thinking about running again? He talked about going back to Texas, to Tennessee, rather, a state that he did lose.
I thought that was a nice reference to go back to Tennessee, and I also liked what he said about the one regret he had about not being able to fight some of the fights that need fighting for those who need the help. And I don't know how to read that in terms of his own political plans. I think Vice President Gore emerges from this with his dignity intact and with some leadership qualities displayed here that maybe weren't fully evident in the campaign. I think in some ways his stature is enhanced by what we've seen in this last month. And I would think that he is the early favorite for 04. That might not be true for the entire 4 years, but I think he comes out of this in a strong position to stay active, to stay involved, if that's what he chooses to do.
Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you very much.
David Price, Democratic Congressman from North Carolina, speaking with us from Chapel Hill.
Vice President Al Gore spoke today from the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is the large building standing immediately next to the White House, and he was there with Vice President, with his vice presidential candidate running mate, Joe Lieberman, and their families standing in the office just off to one side of him. They are all leaving that building now and heading back, presumably, to the vice president's residence, which is shortly going to no longer be their home. We're joined now by Andy Cohut, who is the director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. He's in our Washington, D.C. studio. Andy Cohut, we've talked often during the last few weeks about the attitudes of people about this long drawn out process. Where do you think we sort of have left people right at the end of this process?
Reasonably calm, dispassionate, not seeing a crisis here, and many of the things that Al Gore said today speaks to that. And talking about a common ground, uniting behind Bush, reducing partisanship, those are all things that speak to ordinary Americans' sense of the fact that this was something that we would get through. He did this very well in his acknowledging that the rule of law is most important, even though that it didn't go his way, speaks directly to the public's acknowledgement that this was going to be an ambiguous outcome no matter who won.
He did say that he had a regret that he could not stay and fight, and then he said, especially for those who have particular needs, and I think the references were pretty clear to minority voters. That was one of the strongest groups for Gore in this election.
Yes, and there are many Democrats who feel very badly about this. They think that he won the popular vote. They think that he won the vote in Florida, yet he's still not going to be president. And I think he did well by them, too. I mean, and also in presenting himself in such a wonderful way, in a wonderful human way, with both humor and graciousness and I think that for both the partisans and for the more moderate, independent, centrist, ordinary American Gore, it was a 10 strike.
The speech. Do you suppose we're going to find that there are people out in the country who are taking a second look at Al Gore now that it's no longer possible for him to be president and thinking, whoops, maybe this is a mistake?
Well, that's probably the way it goes. And in this speech, he was least like that overbearing caricature of him on Saturday Night Live of any one of his performances. And people will perhaps remember that, not the overbearing caricature.
As far as I know, you are not planning to do any more polls to measure the response to these speeches, are you?
Not right away.
This has been one of the most polled elections in my memory. And, of course, the polling went on in the post-election period. But even so, I think that we were surprised all the way along the line by the reactions to that voters had.
Yes, the American public was surprising and refreshing with its good judgment about and temperate reaction to things.
Thanks very much, Andy.
You're welcome.
Andy Cohut is the director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. He joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. And, Andy, we hope you will stay with us for a while.
I will.
From NPR News, this is special coverage, the end of the 2000 presidential election. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. Just 30 minutes ago, Vice President Al Gore addressed the nation after the U.S. Supreme Court put an end to his efforts to win a hand recount of thousands of disputed presidential ballots in the state of Florida. Texas Governor George W. Bush will speak 30 minutes from now. Al Gore's final chance of becoming president had hinged on Florida's 25 electoral votes. But when the Electoral College meets on Monday, Bush will have 271 votes, one more than he needs to become president. Gore will have 267. Vice President Gore spoke from his office at the old Executive Office Building near the White House. He was surrounded by his family. His running mate, Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, was also there. We're joined now by Shaka Fatah, a Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania. He's joining us from Philadelphia. Congressman, what do you think about this phrase, defeat may serve as well as victory? Figure of speech, but what do you think?
Well, I think it's true that, you know, we can't just, grin when we win. I mean, we have to wear the same smile when we lose. That defeat, adversity introduces, I think it's been said by Emerson, it introduces one to themselves. And I think that what the vice president said this evening is that he, through this process, has learned even more about, why it's important that we put the issues that his campaign stood for, the issues that more Americans voted for on the last election day, on the front burner. But we have to understand that this contest has come to a conclusion.
Did you hear anything along those lines, anything different in this little talk as compared to the campaign?
Oh, I thought it was an extraordinary speech this evening because it had more to do with this moment. I mean, moments, I think, is clear. It makes the speech, and this is a moment in which the nation needed to hear from the person who they gave the majority of their votes to on the last election as to how he felt given the Supreme Court's decision to take that victory of a popular vote, and perhaps a popular vote win in Florida too, and nonetheless, under the color of law, handed to his opponent. And he had to stand and accept that as he did this evening. I think it was, dramatically and dynamically different than any other speech because of the magnitude of it.
The vice president said he's sorry he didn't get the chance to stay and fight for 4 years, especially for those who need burdens lifted and barriers removed, especially for those who feel their voices have not been heard. I heard you, and I will not forget. And in that context, I want to ask you about the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who's been saying the election flat was stolen, and he's equating driving while black to the crime, he says, of voting while black. Would you rather have heard something from Al Gore that would have moderated those words just a bit?
No, I think that what's important is that obviously Reverend Jackson speaks to a very important constituency. And, if you or I or some of our loved ones were held hostage tonight in Iraq, I think we want to hear from Jesse Jackson. He's a great American. And he's speaking on this issue because it's of great importance to the country. And that is something different than what a candidate like Vice President Gore can say, still has to be said, which is that tens of thousands of people have lost an opportunity to have effect brought to their votes on Election Day, and particularly in Florida. And many of them have been African Americans. But the truth be told, it is not just African Americans. Al Gore got 50 million votes on Election Day. African Americans contributed less than 10 million of those votes. Al Gore has a lot of support. But he, I think, especially found support in the African-American community. And it was because of that that there were attempts to make it more difficult for African-Americans to vote in Florida, which was a key battleground state. And I think that Jackson is correct that there should, notwithstanding this concession, be a Justice Department investigation of that matter. And we need to find out why police decided to have roadblocks or why the Secretary of State would have a program to exclude felons from voting, but that identified, as the Philadelphia Inquirer reported and the Miami Herald and others, literally out of 600 people who were denied the right to vote, only 26 of them were convicted felons. So we need to get to some understanding of some of these details, but I think that that has to be separated from the Vice President's remarks tonight, which is in his role as a candidate who is withdrawing from the contest, he's offered his support to the person who's going to become the next president.
Congressman, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Shaka Fatah is a Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania. He spoke with us from Philadelphia.
Asa Hutchison is a Republican congressman from Arkansas. He is in his home state in Fort Smith. And Congressman Hutchison, you were one of the Republican managers, the House managers, in the Clinton impeachment trial. That was a time of really quite bitter partisanship in the Congress. Now we're looking at a very closely divided House and a completely even Senate. I want to ask you about Governor Bush and what Governor Bush has to do. Do you anticipate that the kind of loss that the Democrats have suffered here, losing an election, not on a knockout but on a decision, do you imagine that that might set some of that kind of bitter partisanship loose in the House and Senate again?
Well, I hope not, and I don't think there's any need for that to occur. We're used to tough and tumble politics in Washington. We're very competitive, but when it's over, we set it aside, as Vice President Gore did tonight, and we move ahead for the good of the country. And I hope that the American people will listen to the calmer voices in Washington, which will be in the majority, versus the shriller voices that call for more rancor and division. And so I hope that it will take some time, but that the tensions will calm. And I'm confident that we can move ahead in Washington. It's going to take some work. It's going to take some good leadership. There's two times, Linda, that I've gone through airports and not looked forward to it. One was after the impeachment. The other one was coming back from Florida, because you could sense the division in our country. People would come up to me and say sort of rough things because of the visibility of these issues and the division that it causes. We've got to get over that, and it starts with leadership in Washington.
Well, now, what kind of leadership do you think that Governor Bush needs to offer to the country tonight? What do you want to hear him say?
Well, obviously, he needs to be gracious, as he will be, toward Vice President Gore, congratulate him on the tough campaign that he ran, and I think a recognition of the understanding of the contest, that it was legitimate in terms of the closeness of the election. He needs to talk to Vice President Gore's supporters, recognizing their disappointment, their frustration, and all he can say is that they should give him a chance, that he will reach out to them and to ask for their support. I think he should ask for the prayers of the country during this very difficult time. And I don't think it needs to be an issue speech. It needs to be a speech from his heart, as Vice President Gore's was, and then he can start toward reaching out to the other side and working on the agenda that he campaigned on.
Just could you answer this in a brief way? But I wonder what you think, what constitutes bipartisanship, what you think he needs to offer the Democrats.
That he won't come with an agenda to them and say, I need your support for it. I think he needs to bring them in at the beginning of the process and say, let's work together to develop legislation that we can agree upon. That's bipartisanship. Now, there's some things he ran on, he's got a commitment to pursue, but others he can work to develop an agenda with them.
Thank you very much, Congressman.
I enjoyed being with you.
Asa Hutchison is a Republican congressman from Arkansas. He was at home tonight in Fort Smith.
And now to Pasadena, California, where we'll speak with Luz Meyerson. She is a Gore supporter. Ms. Meyerson, what did you think of that talk?
Well, I was very impressed, but I was left with a deep sense of loss and disappointment. I think one of the things I need to clarify is that I am Mexican-American, in spite of my last name, and therefore the issues that I felt that Gore would have I think he would have supported the issues that are important to me, and those are anything that helps the underprivileged, and most of all, education. I feel that we, over years, have lost greatly under Republican administration, and education is the key to the future, the key to changing the situations that bring hardship to the underprivileged and people of color. And that's, I feel that sense of loss. I understand that now it's the loyalty to the country, but needs to be exhibited in supporting this decision. But I cannot get over the sense of loss.
You're a bit sad tonight.
Opportunity.
Lost opportunity.
I feel that.
Yes. I want to ask you about the future here, just quite quickly. Mr. Gore, a few days ago, said that if George Bush is inaugurated, he will be my president as well. Do you think that George Bush will be your president?
It'll be a long time before I really feel that. I'm sorry to say, but I can't. I base it on the history of Republicans and the programs and the changes, the loss of affirmative action, Prop 187. I cannot get over that and say, well, yes, Bush will be. I think there will be a lot of proving to do. I would hope to see some sort of gestures and support, not just rhetoric. I want to see that from him, and I want to see it rather quickly in order for me to feel that he is president.
Thank you, Ms. Meyerson.
You're welcome.
Liz Meyerson talking with us in Pasadena, California. And we'll turn now to Penny Latko. She's the co-owner of Pennywise Travel in Lombard, Illinois, and she is a Bush supporter. Well, you heard Ms. Meyerson there. Do you think that Mr. Bush is going to be able to, in a metaphorical way, to a rhetorical way, to reach out to Liz Meyerson?
I really do. I think that his the hallmark, from what I understand, talking to people from Texas, of his governorship in Texas has been to conciliate, to bring people together, to get them to come to consensus, to move forward. And I think he will do that as president as well. I was so impressed with what Al Gore said tonight. It was an Al Gore I hadn't seen before. And he was gracious and conciliatory. And I thought he was really patriotic. My favorite thing that he said was, defeat may serve as well as victory to shake glory from the soul. And I thought that took a lot of understanding of his own personal nature to say that. I'm anxious to hear what the governor has to say, what the president-elect has to say, about what this victory has done for his soul. But I think he is a very good man. I think he's going to put very good people around him. And I think the nation will be served well in his presidency.
We know that Mr. Gore called Mr. Bush earlier in the evening. I just wonder if down in Texas they're rewriting any of Mr. Bush's address to react in a way to what Al Gore had to say.
I think that Al Gore tonight had a speech which touched my soul. And that's really saying something, because I have not been a fan of this man at all. He was very patriotic, and if I were Governor Bush, I would certainly be responding in some way to that gesture of conciliation that Al Gore reached out with tonight. I think that both Mr. Gore and Mr. Bush realized that neither one of them had a majority or a mandate from the American people, and that we have to come together on this common ground. I listened to Christy Whitman, who I have so much respect for, the governor of New Jersey, and she said we need an agenda of compromise and an inclusive agenda. Mayor Webb from Denver said, I think that's what they have to work for. And from what I understand of the gifts of our new president, that ability to compromise and to bring people together is probably his greatest asset. So I expect that this lady from California may find that if she gives him a chance, that this Republican president will bring people together and will reach out to all of the people of this country.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
We have listened to a speech from Vice President Al Gore in which he said that partisan feeling must yield to patriotism, quoting Stephen Douglas. May God bless the president's stewardship of this country, he said about Al Gore, about George Bush, and we will hear from George Bush very soon. You're listening to special coverage of the end of the 2000 presidential election. In just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from President-elect George Bush. We'll have reaction to both speeches and look ahead to the presidency.
This is special coverage from NPR News, the end of the 2000 presidential election. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. In just a few moments, President-elect George W. Bush will address the nation from the Texas House of Representatives in Austin. His speech comes just 1 hour after Vice President Al Gore announced that he had conceded the election to Mr. Bush. Election day was November 7th, 36 days ago.
The U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling last night that ended the vice president's hopes of winning the White House. In a 5-4 decision, the justices reversed the ruling by the Florida Supreme Court that had ordered counties in Florida to resume hand recounts of thousands of disputed ballots.
In his speech tonight, Vice President Gore said he strongly disagreed with the Supreme Court of the United States' opinion, but he accepted it. Gore said he had called earlier to congratulate Mr. Bush on his victory. He urged Americans to unite behind the new president. He said that although he disagreed with the decision, he offered his concession and he honored the president-elect. The speech is going to take place, as Noah has just said, in the Texas State House of Representatives.
And Mr. Bush, we understand, will be introduced by the Democratic Speaker of the House in Texas. His name is Pete Laney. And that would be a bit of a symbol there, Linda.
No question about it. And I think this is intended to show us all that the governor of Texas is willing to reach across the partisan aisle to reach out to Democrats. And this is evidence that he has done it in Texas and presumably can do it and will do it, or at least is going to try to do it. In the U.S. Here's Mr. Laney.
Welcome to the Texas House of Representatives chamber. It was about this time, about 6 years ago, that we were preparing to inaugurate a new governor in Texas. Many of us wondered what kind of leader he would be. We wondered how he would bring everybody together after a hard-fought election. Tonight, many people in our country are asking the same questions about George W. Bush. When he became governor, he reached out to members of the legislature of both parties. We didn't always agree on issues, but we found we could have policy differences without having gridlock. We could have debate without bitterness, and we could reach agreements and solve problems without sacrificing our principles. Above all, we learned that Governor Bush is a leader you can trust and respect. It is my honor to introduce to you a man who has earned my trust and respect, the governor of Texas, my friend, the president-elect of the United States, the Honorable George W. Bush.
Mr. Bush comes into the chamber walking hand in hand with his wife, Laura, and is walking up to the speaker's platform to face an obviously very friendly crowd of supporters in the Texas State House. You can hear the cheering, shaking hands with the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, who's about to get a promotion. Here's the governor.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
The President-elect George Bush.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening, my fellow Americans. I appreciate so very much the opportunity to speak with you tonight. Mr. Speaker, Lieutenant Governor, friends, distinguished guests, our country has been through a long and trying period, with the outcome of the presidential election not finalized for longer than any of us could ever imagine. Vice President Gore and I put our hearts and hopes into our campaigns. We both gave it our all. We shared similar emotions, so I understand how difficult this moment must be for Vice President Gore and his family. He has a distinguished record of service to our country as a congressman, a senator, and a vice president. This evening, I received a gracious call from the vice president. We agreed to meet early next week in Washington, and we agreed to do our best to heal our country after this hard-fought contest. Tonight, I want to thank all the thousands of volunteers and campaign workers who worked so hard on my behalf. I also salute the Vice President and his supporters for waging a spirited campaign. And I thank him for a call that I know was difficult to make. Laura and I wish the Vice President and Senator Lieberman and their families the very best. I have a lot to be thankful for tonight. I'm thankful for America and thankful that we are able to resolve our electoral differences in a peaceful way. I'm thankful to the American people for the great privilege of being able to serve as your next president. I want to thank my wife and our daughters for their love. Laura's active involvement as First Lady has made Texas a better place, and she will be a wonderful First Lady of America. I am proud to have Dick Cheney by my side, and America will be proud to have him as our next vice president. Tonight I chose to speak from the chamber of the Texas House of Representatives because it has been a home to bipartisan cooperation. Here in a place where Democrats have the majority, Republicans and Democrats have worked together to do what is right for the people we represent. We've had spirited disagreements, and in the end, we found constructive consensus. It is an experience I will always carry with me, an example I will always follow. I want to thank my friend House Speaker Pete Laney, a Democrat, who introduced me today. I want to thank the legislators from both political parties with whom I've worked. Across the hall in our Texas Capitol is the State Senate, and I cannot help but think of our mutual friend, the former Democrat Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock. His love for Texas and his ability to work in a bipartisan way continue to be a model for all of us. The spirit of cooperation I have seen in this hall is what is needed in Washington, D.C. It is the challenge of our moment. After a difficult election, we must put politics behind us and work together to make the promise of America available for every one of our citizens. I'm optimistic that we can change the tone in Washington, D.C. I believe things happen for a reason. And I hope the long wait of the last 5 weeks will heighten a desire to move beyond the bitterness and partisanship of the recent past. Our nation must rise above a house divided. Americans share hopes and goals and values far more important than any political disagreements. Republicans want the best for our nation, and so do Democrats. Our votes may differ, but not our hopes. I know America wants reconciliation and unity. I know Americans want progress. And we must seize this moment and deliver. Together, guided by a spirit of common sense, common courtesy, and common goals, we can unite and inspire the American citizens. Together, we will work to make all our public schools excellent, teaching every student of every background and every accent so that no child is left behind. Together we will save Social Security and renew its promise of a secure retirement for generations to come. Together we will strengthen Medicare and offer prescription drug coverage to all of our seniors. Together we will give Americans the broad, fair, and fiscally responsible tax relief they deserve. Together, we'll have a bipartisan foreign policy, true to our values and true to our friends. And we'll have a military equal to every challenge and superior to every adversary. Together, we will address some of society's deepest problems, one person at a time, by encouraging and empowering the good hearts and good works of the American people. This is the essence of compassionate conservatism, and it will be a foundation of my administration. These priorities are not merely Republican concerns or Democratic concerns. They are American responsibilities. During the fall campaign, we differed about the details of these proposals, but there was remarkable consensus about the important issues before us: excellent schools, retirement and health security, tax relief, a strong military, a more civil society. We have discussed our differences. Now it is time to find common ground and build consensus to make America a beacon of opportunity in the 21st century. I'm optimistic this can happen. Our future demands it, and our history proves it. 200 years ago, in the election of 1800, America faced another close presidential election. A tie in the Electoral College put the outcome into the hands of Congress. After 6 days of voting and 36 ballots, the House of Representatives elected Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States. That election brought the first transfer of power from one party to another in our new democracy. Shortly after the election, Jefferson, in a letter titled Reconciliation and Reform, wrote this: "The steady character of our countrymen is a rock to which we may safely moor. Unequivocal in principle, reasonable in manner, we should be able to hope to do a great deal of good to the cause of freedom and harmony." 200 years have only strengthened the steady character of America. And so, as we begin the work of healing our nation, tonight I call upon that character: respect for each other, respect for our differences, generosity of spirit, and a willingness to work hard and work together to solve any problem. I have something else to ask you, to ask every American. I ask for you to pray for this great nation. I ask for your prayers for leaders from both parties. I thank you for your prayers for me and my family. And I ask you to pray for Vice President Gore and his family. I have faith that with God's help, we as a nation will move forward together as one nation, indivisible. And together we will create an America that is open, so every citizen has access to the American dream. An America that is educated, so every child has the keys to realize that dream. And an America that is united in our diversity and our shared American values that are larger than race or party. I was not elected to serve one party, but to serve one nation. The President of the United States is the President of every single American, of every race, and every background. Whether you voted for me or not, I will do my best to serve your interests, and I will work to earn your respect. I will be guided by President Jefferson's sense of purpose: to stand for principle, to be reasonable in manner, and above all, to do great good for the cause of freedom and harmony. The presidency is more than an honor. It is more than an office. It is a charge to keep, and I will give it my all. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
President-elect George W. Bush addressing the nation from the Texas House of Representatives in Austin, Texas. Mr. Bush thanked Al Gore for a telephone call. He mentioned that they would meet in Washington next week. Mr. Bush spoke about many of the themes that he'd raised during the campaign: schools, Social Security, Medicare, prescription drug coverage, tax relief. He once again spoke of compassionate conservatism and of healing and unity. And he said, "I was not elected to serve one party, but one nation." You're listening to special coverage of the end of the 2000 presidential election from NPR News.
We're joined by two men who have been with us throughout the election season, talking about the candidates and their promises and their speeches and how they've done and so forth. E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post and David Brooks of the Weekly Standard are with us here at the finish. Gentlemen, this was a rather different speech from the one we heard from Mr. Gore, but without speaking of it in comparative terms, let's just talk about what did you think? What did you think of this speech, David?
I can't help comparing it. It wasn't as good as Gore's. It wasn't as lofty. It wasn't the speech of someone who has a literary sensibility, which may be indeed true of George W. Bush. There were a lot of banalities, a lot of cliches. Seize the moment and deliver. I'm not sure anybody with a literary sensibility writes that. America, he dreams of an America that is educated so that every child has the key to realize the dream. That is a bit of banality, a bit of a cliche. But it is I think that is essentially George W. Bush, not a lofty writer and speaker, but a basically decent man who has four or five things he really cares about. He hit them in every speech in the campaign. He hit them here. It was the orthodox Bush agenda that he laid out, and a decent agenda, not lofty and grand, but that's George W. Bush.
Talking about, as Noah pointed out, essentially the same litany of things that he talked about in his campaign. There was something of the sort of the symbolic gesture to bipartisanship of appearing in the Texas House, of being introduced by a Democrat who was the Speaker of the House. EJ, what did you think?
Well, I thought that he, as David said, I think it was still too much of the campaign speech. I think he really needed to kind of rise several levels above tonight. And I don't think he quite got there. I think I agree with David that the Gore speech had more of a kind of patriotic uplift to it than this speech did. I also thought that, and maybe this is what happens when you're not the president-elect, I thought Mr. Gore went a little further out of his way to be gracious than Mr. Bush did in this case. He said all the right things. He didn't say anything out of place. But I was struck earlier in the show when you were talking to David Price, the Democratic congressman from North Carolina, and he specifically made a point of talking about the Supreme Court decision yesterday and said that dissenting opinions will be treated more kindly by history than the majority opinions. The fact that David Price, a very mild, moderate man, is worked up enough that he had to put that in the interview. There's a lot of rage among Democrats right now. And I think Bush would have done himself some good to address that a little bit more directly than he did tonight.
We're going to bring in NPR's news analyst Daniel Shore, who has listened to the two speeches at home in Washington and is on his line from his home. Dan?
Yes. Let me go step back a bit. All these 36 days, we've been wondering and arguing about when we were going to get the C speech, the concession speech. And so now at the end, we get the concession speech done very, very gracefully. In that speech, Vice President Gore concedes. He says he congratulates the president-elect on being the president-elect, but doesn't say that he was elected president, just says he has the honor of becoming the president. And that was that. But then you get the speech in return from the now president-elect, and you look at it and you say, what a wonderful country this is that has this kind of ritual where all the nastiness of these 36 days plus 2 years before then are all gone and they're all swept up in a great tradition which helps to bind the country together. We may not long remember what is being said here, but for the moment, it is a very pleasant thing for the country to contemplate that in this nasty, nasty, nasty several days that we've had, it ends this way because the country requires this ritual and gets it.
And Mr. Bush referred specifically to it. He said that he is thankful that we resolve our electoral differences in a peaceful way. And, of course, as we know, it is one of the great miracles of the American democracy, and it doesn't happen in very many places in the world.
Right. Now, I also agree with my colleagues, David and EJ, that if you look at it in terms of who was more effective in it, clearly the vice president was. He's thought for a long time about how he was going to handle this, and he handled it with enormous grace. It is also true that we get from the president-elect things he said many, many times before, but which begin to sound now as though he's in training for his first State of the Union message.
Now, gentlemen, we have had presidents before who have not been the most graceful rhetoricians in the world, who've been quiet men of apparently small accomplishments, but have gone on to be great presidents. Do you think this is a man we're looking at that kind of man here? David, let me ask you very quickly.
Well, I think we go to Dwight Eisenhower, who was no great public speaker, but who was in touch with the tunes of the time and therefore could flow and move instinctually with the times and really get things done.
Thanks very much, E.J. Dionne, David Brooks, and at home in Washington, our own Dan Shore.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
And we return now briefly to Austin, Texas. NPR's Don Gagne joins us from outside the Texas State Capitol building. That's where Mr. Bush made his speech just a few minutes ago. And Don, what's going on there? We'll have Don Gagne in just a second, I think.
Don is, they've been having sort of cold weather in Texas. I think we may, in the enormous crowds and confusion that we generally see following presidential elections around, we may run into some difficulty here.
Hi.
Oh, there he is.
Well, we can hear a little bit of yelling. What are you seeing there, Don?
Hi, the crowd is actually just now starting to disperse. The president-elect's motorcade is just pulling off from the driveway out here on the west side of the Capitol building and heading back to the governor's mansion, and that's where the crowd is going. They're literally running now, trying to keep up with the motorcade, following him all the way back to his official residence. The crowd's bigger than it was when we spoke about 20 minutes ago. It's probably doubled, even tripled in size just in that 10 minutes or so, and it looks like people are still driving up and still arriving.
And what's going on at the governor's mansion?
They are going to celebrate relatively quietly, I think. Again, no big official Bush campaign party or outdoor rally or anything like that. You know, the speech was low-key. We were told it was going to be low-key. And even though there were, you know, cheers inside the chamber tonight, and cheers outside here, the governor is going to go back to the mansion and prepare to get going on the transition. Time is short, they say.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
NPR's Don Gagne from Austin, Texas.
Now, we don't need to worry too much about that crowd because the Texas State Capitol and the governor's mansion are just a few blocks apart. The Texas State Capitol is a giant pink sandstone replica of the United States Capitol, a very beautiful building, I've always thought. George Nethercutt is a Republican congressman from Washington State, and he joins us from his home in Northern Virginia. Mr. Nethercutt, what's your reaction as a Republican member of Congress who's going to be attempting to carry out some of the efforts to change the tone of politics that Governor Bush referred to? What's your reaction to that speech?
Well, my reaction was that I think there's incentive on the part of those of us who serve in the House and the Senate to work with this president, to accept him and take him at his word and his record that he wants to reach across party lines to do what's right for the country. I think he's put us into a position, and I say this in a complimentary way, to rise to the level that he's established for us, and I believe the Congress will.
He says, rise above a House divided. The House is very closely divided and has not been a particularly friendly place over the last few years. Do you think George Bush can actually change things?
I really do. I think I've seen a change in the last 2 years with Speaker Hastert with a different style than his predecessor. And one that I think is extending this hand of conciliation to the extent that you can without sacrificing your principles to the other party and trying to work together. And I think this will be a good match. The House Speaker and the new president And I believe there will be a genuine effort on the part of House Democrats to do the same. Not everybody, but an awful lot of them, I think, will want to work through this process and do what's right.
Thanks very much, Mr. Nethercutt.
Thank you.
Republican Congressman George Nethercutt, he is from Washington State.
And we will speak now with a Democratic Governor, Gray Davis of California. Governor Davis, what did you think of George Bush's speech down there in Austin?
I thought it was a good speech. He clearly reached out to the vice president, acknowledged that both candidates and their campaigns had been through really an unprecedented and very trying experience. And obviously, one person has to lose. And I thought George Bush had really grasped the hand of friendship that Al Gore extended during his speech. I think both men were positive and gracious and spoke to the best of America rather than the worst of America.
Well, let me ask you about something that E.J. Dionne said just a few minutes ago, talking about rage among Democrats, not wanting to let this go, rage among portions of the electorate who may feel underrepresented in the actual vote. What's your feeling about that?
I feel very strongly that those of us privileged to serve in government get our authority from the consent of the governed. That is expressed through the ballot box. And I was very disappointed with the Supreme Court's decision. Yes, I accept it. I respect them as the final arbiter, but I don't agree with it, because what it practically did was stop us from hearing exactly what the governed were communicating to us. I just do not believe there were 30 or 40,000 people who went to the polls in Florida with absolutely no intention of voting for anyone for president. And when the machine says they didn't have a preference, I think it's our obligation to look at them by hand and see if, in fact, we can determine whether or not they were telling us who they preferred to be the next president. Because this is not Al Gore or George Bush's election. This election belongs to the people of America. And I was disappointed that we did not take a greater effort to divine the intent of the voter. I can understand why people feel very angry about that and harbor a lot of resentment. But in America, we have a longstanding tradition of rallying around our new president, whoever that might be. And while I prefer to be Al Gore, it's going to be George Bush. And we have to give him a chance to succeed and try and work with him to solve the problems of America.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, sir.
Governor Gray Davis of California, a Democrat.
And now Robert Dalek is back with us. He's a professor of history at Boston University. He's written a number of books about presidents of the past. Now, let me just put the question to you that I raised a moment ago. Mr. Bush's speech was not an exciting speech, I think we could say. It was a conciliatory speech. It was a reaching out sort of a speech. But Al Gore's speech was a sort of a more shining moment in terms of rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But he would not be the first president we've ever had who we were prepared to underestimate and were surprised by. Do you think that's possible?
Sure. They said of George Washington, he may have been first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, but he was last in speechmaking. Thomas Jefferson was very uncomfortable with public speaking, so much so that he broke the tradition of going before the House to give the State of the Union message and began the tradition of sending forward a written message. So it's not a requirement that you be a great speechmaker. On the other hand, in this day and age of television and mass communication, I think it certainly helps. And this was a moment when I think it would have been better if there had been a stronger literary effort on President-elect Bush's part. And I think my colleagues are quite right that the Gore speech was a more inspiring and emotional one. I mean, it touched people, I think. As we heard from your Republican in St. Louis, I guess it was, she was very touched by Gore's speech.
And do you think that we will see more of or less of George Bush? You think we're looking at a president, very briefly, that is going to be a quiet sort of retiring kind of president, a behind-the-scenes president?
Well, if the measure of what we've seen in the last 30 or so days, that would probably be true, because they don't seem to put him front and center. But we'll see. This is an evolving situation, and this is what he's got to prove to us.
Thanks very much, Robert Dalek.
My pleasure.
You're listening to special coverage of the end of the 2000 presidential election from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage, the end of the 2000 presidential election. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. With two speeches tonight, the hotly contested and unprecedentedly long presidential election finally concluded. Vice President Al Gore addressed the nation 90 minutes ago and conceded, he used that word, the election to Texas Governor George Bush. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a 5-4 ruling yesterday that ended Gore's hopes of winning the presidency. The justices reversed the decision of the Florida Supreme Court that had ordered counties to manually recount contested presidential ballots. That means Bush's electoral vote majority will stand. 30 minutes ago, George W. Bush spoke to the nation for the first time as president-elect.
Andy Kohut joins us. He is the director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press and has been conducting polling all through the election season, excuse me, and sharing that polling with us. Andy, George Bush and Al Gore basically split the voters. This was a tied election. George Bush presumably needs to speak not only to his voters, but to Al Gore's. But let's just separate out. I mean, who were the people who voted for this man, who voted for the president-elect?
There were men. They were whites. They were affluent. They lived in smaller towns and communities and not in big cities. They were conservative. This was an election in which the Republican and conservative side of the country went one way, and the Democratic and liberal side went the other way, and split right down the middle, almost as if we didn't have candidates. And the two candidates canceled each other out, and we had almost a generic Republican running against a generic Democrat. And that's why it was so close.
Now, when he talks about reaching across and talking about how Republicans and Democrats both want the same kinds of things for the country. There are groups that he has to particularly reach out to if he's going to be the uniter, not the divider, as he said during the campaign. But it's not going to be easy, presumably, because, you know, if you gather in one group, you may cut out another.
Yeah, he's got a strong conservative Republican base that is now celebrating Republicans up and controlling both up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. But he has to recognize, and he did in this speech, that he was elected by he's a minority president. About 24% of American citizens voted for George Bush, and somewhat fewer than voted for Al Gore. And that's why he said the bipartisan more often in this speech than Gore said lockbox in the first debate. I mean, he was really driving home, you know, that he acknowledges this. And he was also not elected on the basis of issues. People who are interested in issues voted for Gore. That's why he restated his mandate. He went through a tax cut and Social Security and the litany of things that he wants to accomplish, because those things don't emanate naturally as much as for other presidents from his election victory.
So do you see difficulty for him in carrying out this, in sort of universalizing his mandate across the whole country?
Maybe not. You know, we might be in for a big surprise. It wasn't a shining moment in this speech, as you put it, but he has a common touch. It wasn't elegant, but he said the things that he had to say, and he just might surprise us, and the American spirit might be there to pressure Washington to come together, and he might in fact do the job.
And of course, in this country, we are always predisposed to like our presidents rather than otherwise, and unless we have some reason not to.
I'll bet you $5 he gets a honeymoon.
Thanks very much, Andy. Andrew Kohut, who is the director of the Pew Center for the People and the Press. Noah?
Let's talk now with Robert Dalek, professor of history at Boston University, a presidential historian. Let's take the long view of history. This day, the 13th of December, yesterday was the 12th in the Supreme Court decision. Will any of this be remembered? Will Bush versus Gore, for example, be remembered in presidential history, do you think?
Oh, without question. It's been such an unusual election. But I think what historians are going to try to sort out is what brought us to this pass. And I think they're going to have to look back to the past 30 or 40 years. And what they're going to say is that, going back to the Kennedy assassination, I don't think we've gotten over that yet. There's still suspicion about government. Oliver Stone's film, which raised the idea that Kennedy may have been killed by government officials, Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War and the credibility gap, Watergate, Richard Nixon, Reagan, Iran-Contra, Bill Clinton's impeachment scandal. See, there's been a whole series of events which I think has eroded the influence of the president, of the presidency, and the end of the Cold War. The end of the Cold War has diminished the stature, the importance, the prosperity that we enjoy. And so I think there's been this shift away from reliance on the president. And it's not the first time in our history this has happened. We had a series of essentially nameless, faceless characters in the late 19th century. Theodore Roosevelt inaugurated the modern presidency. It's been sort of up and down ever since. But I think this will be seen as something of a punctuation mark on the end of the imperial presidency, not permanently, but at least for the time being.
You've mentioned a lot of items that could turn out to be conspiracy theories,
mm-hmm.
and I just wonder what President-elect Bush will have to do in the next 4 years to sort of rise above this last 5 weeks.
Yeah. Well, what he's got to do is inspire the country. John Kennedy might be a good model for him, though the times are very different, and it's difficult for him to address a big foreign policy question the way Kennedy did. But Kennedy was an inspirational voice. This very close election in 1960, he came across to people as intelligent, as forceful, as a leader, as someone who led. Now, this speech by Bush was disappointing in the sense that one did not feel a man who thinks for himself, who is putting forth ideas. I mean, it was the litany, as we heard before, of ideas we heard through the campaign. You need something that's fresh. Indeed, I think the first thing he should do is propose the Voting Rights Act of 2001. In which he suggests that there be uniform ballot boxes or machines across the country. Do something a little bit bold, a little bit imaginative that can capture the public's imagination and attention and excite interest again in politics and in the idea of voting, you see, because as Andy pointed out, Bush goes to the White House with about 24% of the electorate supporting him.
Come out right away for electoral reform.
Yes, absolutely.
A tiny footnote here. George Bush will be the second father, part of the second father and son combination in the White House.
Yes, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, George Bush, George W. Bush.
Thank you, Mr. Dalek.
My pleasure.
Robert Dalek, professor of history at Boston University.
We're going to go now to speak to Mark Roscoe, who is the Republican governor of Montana, and he is back at home in his state capital. But, Governor, we've seen quite a lot of you from Florida and from other places speaking for George Bush during this post-election period. And the message that we heard from him tonight was a little bit different from the one you were delivering in your efforts to support him in his fight right after the election to get to this point.
Well, clearly we were speaking to different issues. There's no doubt about that. We were talking about since the date of the election up until yesterday about the evidence that was prevailing there in Florida concerning voting and the process that was engaged there. And tonight, of course, the governor, now president-elect, is speaking to the nation after that contest has been concluded. So you're quite right. There were issues of equal protection and fair play and discussions about what should be pursued and what should not be pursued up until this point in time. I think that now that the contest has been settled, that obviously President-elect Bush is properly directed toward those things that he thinks are important to heal any divisions that may have occurred and to proceed in a way that serves all of America appropriately and meets with their expectations.
What do you think are the important first steps for the President-elect?
Well, I think the first step was taken this evening by both Vice President Gore and by President-elect Bush by recognizing that this was a very difficult journey, that it certainly did not turn out precisely as each of them would want it to turn out. There obviously is only one that can be successful and one that is not. I thought the vice president was extremely gracious and delivered what I thought were remarks that signaled to the rest of the country that he fully intended and believed that it was appropriate now for all of us to close ranks after this very close contest. And I believe that Governor Bush, President-elect Bush now, is was doing the same thing, trying to speak to the nation and accept the gracious concession from the vice president, and also to pay particular attention to the fact that we have in this country many things for us to address. There were many common issues that were addressed during the campaign. Mm-hmm. He has a record of reaching across the aisle to work with others who may start out with a different perspective to try and do good things for the people of this country. So I think that those were the important first steps taken by both of these men after a very long and difficult election contest.
After you, your yeoman service in Mr. Bush's on Mr. Bush's behalf in the campaign, there's been talk of a cabinet post for you. Are you very briefly? Are they talking to you? Are you interested?
I have had no discussion so far, and I have to say firmly that I have been a strong supporter because of my great belief and confidence and affection for President-elect Bush, and never have expected anything in return for that. I just believe that America is going to, as they see him govern, be very pleased with the way that he can touch the hearts of America and do good things for all of the people of this country.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Governor Mark Roscoe is a Republican governor from Montana. He joined us tonight from Helena. And we're going to talk now to Ken Duberstein, who took part in both the 1980 and 1988 presidential transitions in two different administrations. He served as White House Chief of Staff in the Reagan administration, and he joins us now from his home in Washington. Kenny Duberstein, what did you think about the beginning that George Bush has made?
I think he set the right tone tonight about reaching out and trying to build bipartisanship. I think it is fundamentally important to the success he will have in a brief honeymoon period that he starts courting not only Democrats but also Republicans. I think he is under the gun as far as having to hit the ground running in 6 weeks. It is going to be a very compressed transition. But he really needs to romance the Congress through bipartisanship, by finding common ground. And I think he really achieved that this evening.
We also have with us Martha Joint Kumar, who heads the White House 2001 Project, which is preparing information on how the White House works for the new president, looking at both transitions into the office and at governing once the office is achieved. Martha Kumar, this will be, as Kenny Duberstein just said, a really compressed transition.
Is that
going to make it difficult?
Well, it does, because we are in midpoint in a transition. And by this time in 1968, President-elect Nixon, had appointed all of his cabinet. And the sixth and seventh weeks of a transition are generally the time when those positions are appointed, cabinet and cabinet-level positions.
So would you expect Mr. Bush to move very fast at this point? Presumably he's had time to think about it.
He has. One of the things I think that they have working for them is that they did begin their process early, well before the election date, to gather information on positions and appropriate people to fill them. The personnel process has a lot of unforgiving deadlines that are built into it. For example, there'll be FBI investigations that just simply take a certain number of days. If it's a new person who is new to the process, it's perhaps around 45 days, and somebody who requires an update is 30 days.
And there aren't that many days.
That's correct.
Noah?
Ms. Kumar, I just wondered, are there people now on the market for George Bush who were not available until these two speeches tonight?
Well, certainly they will be, although they must have begun their discussions with people and have it pretty well laid out who they want for cabinet. But the sub-cabinet level is going to take time, and they are going to be particularly important to get the government moving in the direction you want. You want to get those sub-cabinet level people in as early as you can. And, for example, in the Reagan administration, they were able to get them in a lot earlier than was true in the Clinton administration.
Which took longer to hire than any administration in my memory. Ken Duberstein, you were going to say?
Well, I was going to suggest that in the 17 days from January 3rd until the inauguration, Democrats are going to have nominal control of the United States Senate. And wouldn't it be a grand bipartisan gesture if Tom Daschle scheduled early confirmation hearings on the people nominated by President-elect Bush to serve in his cabinet? I think that is the kind of symbol of extending the hand of bipartisanship that certainly will reinforce a change in tone in Washington.
But doesn't the gesture have to come in the other direction first?
I think the
Democrats are feeling a bit aggrieved here.
But I think Governor Bush did that this evening, and I think you're going to hear him put at the very top of his plate day in and day out between now and January 20th, reaching out and finding common ground with Democrats.
What would you think bipartisanship would look like? You handled congressional relations for President Reagan, and you know the House and Senate.
In the first 3 years, right.
What does bipartisanship look like, do you think, in this next administration?
Not courting Democrats on one vote or one issue, but courting them across the board. One of the things that Reagan had us do is visit every member of Congress to extend the hand of friendship, Republican and Democrat alike, as he was talking about the importance of governing and putting together a bipartisan coalition. Because remember, there were only 191 Republicans when he first was elected. He needed 27 Democrats every time in order to prevail. What I think Governor Bush is going to do, President-elect Bush is going to do, is find several so-called leftover issues, leftover from the Clinton years, prescription drug benefits, reducing death taxes, repealing the marriage penalty, education reform, picking those issues and finding the common ground with the Democrats to demonstrate that he can govern and he can change the tone and bring people together.
Thanks very much.
Then it becomes possible to do the other big issues like tax cuts and Social Security.
Ken Duberstein, thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. Enjoyed it.
Also, Martha Joyn Kumar, thank you. We appreciate your being with us tonight.
Thank you.
President-elect George Bush, within the hours, spoke to the nation from the State House, the State Capitol building in Austin, Texas. And now we're going to speak with E.J. Dionne, a columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and with David Brooks, senior editor at The Washington Standard. And let's go back to what we were talking about earlier with historian Robert Dalek. If, indeed, George Bush is reaching out across the aisle, this idea of election reform could have been a concrete thing, David Brooks, to put in this speech tonight. He had plenty of time. He could have talked about that.
Well, I think once the Bush machine gets going, it sticks to its issues. That's been the Bush record in Texas. That's the Bush record here. He did underline in the speech one issue or one issue group where he really could reach across party lines. He emphasized compassionate conservatism. When he first started running for president, he gave a substantive policy speech in Indianapolis and then a subsequent one in New York City in Manhattan, where he laid out a series of policy agendas having to do with the poor, urban issues, housing, traditional Democratic concerns. A lot of them were tax credits, some were federal grants, but it's a series of policy issues where Democrats would generally support him. And if he pushed those sets of policies, they're not huge, but they're significant. He pushed those to the fore. I would think that would get things going off in a reasonably good area. So he wouldn't have to rely only on the leftover issues, which Ken Duberstein mentioned, but have a distinctive Bush policies, which really would lay the groundwork for bipartisanship.
E.J. Dionne, let's go back to the days in Texas as George Bush's record as governor there would indicate. He has been quite adept at building coalitions in Texas.
It's true, but of course, when you talk about Texas Democrats, you're not talking about Washington Democrats. I mean, I'm from Massachusetts, and there are Texas Democrats conservative enough that they couldn't get into the Republican Party in Massachusetts. So it's a much easier climate philosophically and ideologically But yes, what they do say in Texas about George Bush is that he is very good at building personal relationships. He mentioned Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, a legendary Democrat who died a couple of years back. And Bush realized early on, I need Bullock. I've got to build a relationship with him. And Bob Bullock really helped George Bush be a much more effective governor than he wouldn't have been without that relationship. But to go back to something David said, I agree with some of what Ken Duberstein said, but I think a Republican administration doesn't want cutting the inheritance tax to be its first achievement out of the box. And I do think this compassionate conservative agenda is something that could work. And it's also, those were also the most moving speeches Bush gave. There was much more rhetorical lift to those speeches than, say, to the speech we heard earlier tonight.
Do you have the feeling, either one of you, that there's something in George Bush's character and personality makeup that he's in a way saying, I'll be able to do these things, just trust me here, just go with this promise of my presidency, and he doesn't really want to come out and make grandiose promises?
Well, he is not a grandiose person. He's also not an ideological person. You know, one of the keys to understanding Bush, I've always thought, is his student days at Yale, 1968. Half the campus is against the war in Vietnam. Some of the campus is for it. He's neither. You know, he deals with friendships and personalities. He sees people not in ideological camps, but as personalities and individuals, quite apart from their ideology. And that is different from the sort of Verdun-like partisan conflict we now have here in Washington. And that may really be a new governing style.
Interesting meeting coming up next week. It could be at the White House between George Bush and Al Gore. Possibly President Clinton would be there.
And I wonder what they're going to say to each other at that meeting beyond what they've already said tonight. I imagine that President Clinton will feel George Bush's difficulties transitioning into this job. I think that on this issue of bipartisanship, there are really going to be two kinds of bipartisanship, and there's going to be a war inside the Republican Party over which one to pursue. One approach is to pass conservative things with as many Democratic votes as you need. If that happens, I think the honeymoon is going to be short-lived, even though he might pass some things. The other kind is what Ken Duberstein talked about, which is a broader bipartisanship that governs more from the middle. And we're going to see which kind he's going to pursue.
Thank you, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks, senior editor at The Weekly Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to recap the evening, 36 days after voters went to the polls, Vice President Al Gore has conceded the 2000 presidential election. That means George W. Bush will be sworn in as the nation's 43rd president on the 20th of January. NPR's coverage of the transition continues tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Our director this evening is Bob Boylan. The editor is Jonathan Kern. Our technical director is Preston Brown.
Production help from Julie Redpath, Jeff Rogers, Franklin Cater, Matt Martinez, Carol Klinger, Darcy Bacon, Tashima Walker, and Michael Lawrence. Audio engineer Sean Campbell, Peter Elena, Mitch Eaton, Joel Titman, and Sue Klein.
Our executive producer is Ellen Weiss. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams for NPR News.